Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Chris Hutton. Before we get into the news stories of today, I just want to make a quick announcement. The Institute of Race Relations is hosting the 46th Hoenlea Memorial Lecture. The person giving the lecture this year is Professor Hussein Solomon, who's going to be speaking on the topic of embracing Machiavelli to achieve a liberal future. It's going to be held on the 6th of November at 5:30 for 6 in the evening in Parktown in Johannesburg. Tickets are 120 Rand per person, and we will have a link to that in the comment section on YouTube. All right, with that out of the way, let us talk about what we're going to be speaking on today. We're going to talk a little bit about the latest legal drama around former President Jacob Zuma, who has had another, well, what looks like it might be a bit of a significant legal defeat. We're also going to talk about inflation and the interest rate. And lastly, fears that South African business have around climate targets and environmental regulation. So let's start off talking about Zuma. On Wednesday, so today earlier, the Gauteng High Court in Pretoria ordered that Zuma has to repay the 28.9 million rand in state-funded legal fees that were spent on defending him. And crucially, his pension as a former president can be attached to pay this back. The Gauteng High Court said that should the president fail to honor that debt within 60 days, the state attorney can seek to attach his pension and assets. Zuma's order to pay back 28,960,774 rand and 34 cents, which is monies advanced for his legal fees and associated expenses. This was granting the DA's application for a specific amount of interest to be paid on the sum. So, Chris, firstly, I just want to say, you know, this does seem like one of those things where, you know, Zuma's, you know, he's no stranger to losing court battles, right? He happens to happen all the time. And he's traditionally had this sort of Stalingrad approach of just delay, dispute, fight back on every point. And I'm sure we're going to see more of that. You know, this is not the end of the story. But it is interesting that he's now sort of losing battles on the money front, which I think is his kind of his great big weakness. And it really does look like he's going to need some help, perhaps, from some of his supporters in KZN, if he's going to be able to get out of this one, I suspect. The question, though, is, you know, the last time that courts tried to enforce something on Jacob Zuma was when they put out that arrest warrant for him in 2021, and the response to that was riots across KZN and other parts of the country, but mainly in KZN. The question remains, Chris, are we going to see a repeat of that if Zuma is backed into enough of a corner by losing enough legal battles?
So, yeah, one way to not to have to worry about whether you're going to win or lose a court case is to shift the battle onto a different the battle onto a different field. So if it is, then through things like social unrest, disruption, indirectly or directly casting doubt and aspersions on the court, the specific courts, and also on South Africa's judiciary, on judges, that they're, you know, bought and biased. All of that kind of thing creates the sort of pressure environment where you might then incentivize your legal problems, your legal troubles being solved in different ways. So either someone comes to bail you out, someone domestically or sort of international savior, perhaps from the east towards the east of Europe, or possibly from the Middle East, or alternatively, you just create the kind of environment where it's just not possible for the worst outcome of the judgment against you to be actually implemented. So I by no means discount it. I don't see that we're yet facing something similar to July 2021. In terms of both Zuma's influence and also in terms of just the kind of pressure point that the country faced then during lockdowns, of course, in a low growth, high unemployment situation. The latter two are still the case, unfortunately, 4 years later. But we don't have the kind of pressure point from lockdowns repeatedly from the pressure of a pandemic, that sort of thing. So don't discount Zuma's influence still. People will be, I don't know, people continue to underestimate him in various instances, obviously politically, as the ANC has found out to its cost in last year's elections. But sort of businesses and society do tend to underestimate still the influence that he can extend. So when one looks at pressure points for social unrest in a province like KwaZulu-Natal, it would be apt to keep a keen eye on court dates, on these kinds of timelines that would give one the kind of preparatory work. If you have business dealings, if you have supply chains, value chains more exposed in KZN and in Gauteng, because these things do have the potential to flare up again, especially around the individual that is Jacob Zuma. You couple that with the, that is shown on a daily basis, the incapacity of our police service, of our intelligence services. I mean, this is exposed almost daily in the testimony at the Madlanga Commission. That then means there isn't really a balance of forces to then push back should enough individuals be mobilized to voice their frustrations around the perceived persecution of someone like Jacob Zuma. So that then means it's easier for those sort of actors to implement whatever sort of plans they might have in place.
Yeah, you know, I do wonder though, as you know, as you mentioned, how much of those July 2021 riots, obviously there were lots of things at play there. You know, you can't say it's any one thing. You know, there were bad actors on the ground who like kind of tried to gin up things and encourage stuff, and, you know, were breaking open the gates of malls and things like that. And so there was some of that organized stuff, but it certainly took on a life of its own and spread, I think, far beyond any kind of, you know, it's not like everyone who was looting shops in KZN was, you know, paid by Zuma or encouraged mm-hmm. specifically by Zuma or even really cared that much about Zuma. Yeah. I do wonder how much of that was really due to the lockdowns and the weird stresses that happened in 2020 and 2021. You know, there were lots of kind of riots and chaotic public events across the world in that period. So I do wonder how, even if the same thing was tried again, whether you'd be able to get it off in the same way. As you say, you know, we do have all these really serious social problems, which haven't gotten any better. Unemployment, kind of lack of law and order, you know, bad socioeconomic conditions, all these other things. But I remember reading a piece about how there were quite a few people who were interviewed anonymously after the fact in those riots, who basically said, yeah, we kind of regret that because we just ruined our local mall and now we can't buy from it. And I wonder whether the bitter taste of that might not dissuade people from joining in again. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think those are very good points that I very much take on board. I guess even the bitter taste might be sort of, you might override that by, if you're good enough at telling a different sort of twist on a story around victimhood and persecution, so that Zuma, what he represents, you know, the will of the people, the real ANC, the real sort of man of the people versus the elites in Pretoria. And this is again a case of the courts trying to keep him and the people down. It's more about the people. So it depends on, again, how effective one could be at drumming up that narrative. And also, I guess as people become more disillusioned.
The infrastructure of MK such as it is to kind of back him this time, which, you know, I think a lot of the structures that make up MK today probably already existed back in 2021 supporting Zuma, but they weren't as sort of, it wasn't like a clear brand in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to sort of close the thought there, it also, a lot will depend on, I think you might see around things like these court cases and the timelines, you might see more sporadic things like it'll be couched as service delivery protests. You'll see if actors align to this kind of grouping, how they're trying to test local security forces, how they're trying to test the police. Are there road closures? Are there more protests? Is it ostensibly linked to service delivery issues or is it not? That's also a way for them to then gauge, is there going to be any kind of pushback? And to link to what you mentioned earlier on July 2021, one good thing that came out of it, of course, is a sort of muscle memory that the private sector and communities built up in that moment. So the way that they dealt with that in many instances in KZN, that kind of thing, hopefully, I don't think it has, but hopefully hasn't gone away, that those local community, policing forums, security companies. They've built those kinds of links with each other, the kind of anti-fragility that would dissuade the kind of riot, level of rioting that we saw in July of 2021, regardless of whether you have an animating force like Zuma, assuming he can capture again the kind of narrative like he did in many previous instances.
All right, let's move on to our next topic. News out about inflation that it has accelerated again. In August, prices rose by about 3.3%. And in September, which is the latest data we have, prices rose by 3.4%. I think a lot of this was driven by meat, I think, was one of the things that was driving it, which is, of course, important for many people's grocery shopping. And now there's some questions about whether the South African Reserve Bank is actually going to cut interest rates at the next meeting, because it's, you know, quite keen on making sure that inflation is kept under control, which I think is a pretty good idea for those non-economists, and I certainly count myself in that category. Inflation really is one of the most destructive forces. You know, there are few countries that ever kind of really recover from hyperinflation, as we know from Zimbabwe, from Venezuela, from other countries like that. And, you know, keeping a strong check on the value of your money seems to be a really important thing there. Chris, what does this mean? I mean, am I correct in my assessment there that inflation really is something to be avoided? And what do you make of this news?
Of course, it doesn't help when even if your reserve bank is as, or your central bank is as proactive as ours. I mean, they started their interest rate hiking, tightening cycle before even the US Federal Reserve a few years ago. And that helped keep out some of our, what we're more exposed to, usually imported inflation. But even if you have this very independent, proactive central bank, that can't do the work of other government entities, institutions, departments on the supplier side drivers of higher prices and high inflation. So here we talk about administered prices, those prices set by national, provincial, metro governments. That's your electricity prices, water tariffs, waste, all sorts of things that you see on your municipal bill, for which probably outside the Western Cape, you don't get the kind of services for which you are paying in those monthly statements month after month. So those drive prices higher, business costs, and of course those costs are passed on to consumers. If you couple that with generally a weakening currency, and again, this is linked to our domestic sectors like manufacturing, construction, being weak for, let's say, on 15 years now, that then over time weakens the value of our currency. In this particular instance, in the last 2 months, we've seen month-on-month upticks in inflation. I'm hoping that this is on the back of more consumer activity and consumer spending, because we had interest rate cuts, so people can, in some small ways, spend more. It's not to say it's going to get us to 3% growth. But on the back of those interest rates, you are seeing some households having a bit more breathing room. And that does then lead to more economic activity. The issue is, again, if we don't deal with those other issues that push prices higher artificially, so electricity supply, water supply, security, where businesses have to outlay spending on private security versus police, ports, railways, all that sort of stuff that our businesses have to spend more on, and the costs that are passed on to consumers and households. If those things aren't handled, then effectively the Reserve Bank can keep hiking interest rates, and it won't ever get a real handle on the proper drivers of inflation. Maybe just the last point. Yeah, it's also always important to keep in mind inflation. I don't know if I go along with it in all instances. It's a monetary phenomenon, which is to say that if you just keep printing money, there will be inflation. I do think it holds maybe in 99% of cases when you have more notes of a currency chasing fewer goods because the economy isn't growing, you devalue that currency over time. That has proven the case in South Africa's story. But at this point in time, we haven't seen a sort of just massive printing cycle on the part of the Reserve Bank, on the South African government. They've been tempted, of course, to spend massively on things like the NHI. They do spend a lot on social grants. But it's not, in South Africa's case, I think purely a monetary phenomenon. It's on the government policy, government sort of supply side drivers issues. That's why I think our inflation remains so relatively sticky. It's good, of course, that it's lowered towards 3% in the last 3 to 4 months. But you ideally wanted more below 3% and towards 2%. That really puts a lot more value in the Rand going forward.
Yeah, I think that's all very true. Yes, no, you know, I think it's very important that you point out the limitations of the Reserve Bank. And you know, if you just, South Africa has been very well served by a bunch of these quite small, these financial institutions in government, the Reserve Bank, the finance ministry in general has tended to be okay. I mean, you know, during Trevor Manuel's time back at a certain point in the Mbeki presidency, we even had a government surplus, which is a rare thing these days, it seems, from across the world. But yeah, you know, those days are long past us. We've spent away that inheritance during the Zuma years and into the Ramaphosa years. And, you know, the Reserve Bank can fiddle around with interest rates as much as it likes, but it's not, you know, unless you get all those other policy steps right, you know, you can't magically change the economy. You know, there's like sometimes a push from many on the far left to say, no, we need to cut the interest rates right now to, you know, juice up economic growth. You know, unless you get rid of the actual proper problems, you're not going to like just magic everything. In fact, you're probably just going to cause inflation and problems. Okay, let's move on to our next topic. There is, I believe, the COP30 summit is starting soon. That's the sort of big international climate change discussion that goes on around the world. There's going to be discussions of various targets and agreements and, you know, what needs to be done to ensure that, you know, there's a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, that kind of stuff. And Business Unity South Africa is putting out a warning ahead of time that government mustn't agree to anything too strict when it comes to environmental regulations. According to Business Unity South Africa, prematurely shutting down emissions-intensive trade-exposed sectors could trigger major economic fallout, including a GDP decline of more than 10% and a 9% drop in employment. They said, we urge government to adopt a phased, flexible, incentive-based mitigation framework that reflects central differentiation and allows for decarbonization aligned with technology readiness and market demand. It's a very corporate way of saying that. But basically, they're saying don't ban important industries for an environmental target. And, I made this point on Monday, but I just want to stress it again before I get to you, Chris, that you know, a weak economy is also often bad for the environment because you often have to rely on worse technology, dirtier technologies. You can't invest sort of surplus resources in various environmental projects. You look at the countries that have some of the most polluting, diseased, toxic environments, and it's often ones that are either recently have just achieved some sort of level of wealth because they've desperately been trying to escape poverty, or it's ones that are poor still. I mean, you know, like, for example, plastic in the oceans is like mostly driven by very poor countries who are dumping stuff. So, you know, having a strong, healthy economy that can produce stuff and is technologically advanced is also actually good for the environment. And I think it's important that Business Unity South Africa kind of raises the costs of some of these things. I don't know, Chris, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, that last point I really want to agree with you and reinforce, because it's generally been the case with bigger corporates, bigger businesses in South Africa. They do tend to go along with more bureaucratic, technocratic proposals for our problems. For the last, you know, 30 years, arguably, the temptation to let's just get the right people in place, let's just have the right kind of state capacity in place, and we can deal with these issues. And that very much stifles, I think, real economic competition, real economic development. It does benefit those sort of in the room who can then get to decide these policies, but it doesn't benefit the country as a whole. So if there's follow through on this, on this rhetoric to say, look, this, there should be some nuance, to put it very delicately, in South Africa pursuing this kind of route in terms of renewable energy, climate emission targets. If it follows with real action from where the money sits in South Africa, then I think it's a very good sort of first step on that path. We see also here, you could see some linkages here, South Africa's relationship, diplomatic and trading, with entities like the European Union, where the EU is imposing the CBAM, carbon border emissions regulations soon. What that means for a country like South Africa, of course, because we would export steel, other manufactured products if those goods, those products are made through processes that have higher carbon emissions, you receive a prohibitively high sort of tariff against it, possibly to the level where you can't then export to some of your key export markets. And again, what that does to development in countries like South Africa, where, you know, even with the pressure that the steel industry is under manufacturing more broadly, they still contribute significantly to GDP, not what they should be doing. And that's, again, because of our own domestic policy choices and drivers. But it doesn't help when your trading partners, who are ostensibly there to help push development and growth in your country, that they impose those requirements on you. That sort of this kind of, you know, geopolitical moment does call for a bit more pragmatic, growth-focused trade policies, I think.
Yeah, this is the problem with doing business with Europe. You know, Europe remains our biggest trading partner, but you know, the Europeans often will have sort of strings attached and want you to put this environmental regulation or curb this climate-related activity or whatever. And you know, it's very easy to say when you're in Europe and you don't have the same problems that we do in Africa. And I think that temptation must be resisted, no matter how much the promise of cheap climate green financing is held out. And besides, you know, with a lot of the problems that Europe is facing now, I wonder whether that money is really good for the long term, or whether, you know, this is more a temporary phenomenon. Any final words, Chris, before we close up for today?
Maybe just to add some recommended reading. So if people haven't already, I mean, if you want to delve more into sort of, I guess, development economics linked to reliable, cheap energy supply, is the work of Alex Epstein and one of his books, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. Just, you know, even if one is fully on the sort of renewables path in terms of what you think would be best from an energy point of view for the environment, go and read, you know, Alex on this topic from a human development point of view, but also on the point of view on the impact of the environment, as you highlighted, where poorer countries, it's just much more difficult to deal with actual pollution, to deal with negative impact on the environment, where Alex, I think, lays out very well how countries, developing countries, emerging markets like South Africa, they need to tap into abundant, reliable, cheaper forms of energy, especially for the time being. And then maybe later you can start talking about other forms of energy. Again, assuming they can compete with fossil fuels without subsidies, without gaming the system and gaming markets. I think that's very important.
All right. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. And we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day. The Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.